I'm Sarah Austin Jeunesse, The Moth's executive producer and longtime host of The Moth Podcast. Every week, we share true stories told live and without notes by real people from all walks of life. Stories about disastrous haircuts, May-December romances, photographing Pluto, fighting for justice, and so much more. Some stories make you laugh, some make you think, and many stay with you long after they're told. Discover the power of story. Follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. As the midterm election nears and the margins between Democrats and Republicans get slimmer, Donald Trump's team advised the GOP to stop talking about hardline immigration tactics. This comes after Kristi Noem was fired and amid a new labor market slowdown that indicated the lack of new immigrants joining the workforce is hurting the economy. Speaker Mike Johnson even acknowledged recently that some immigration actions may have alienated Hispanic voters. So, let's discuss the latest in immigration news. First, from KCBS.
President Trump and several federal officials have long used immigrant crime as justification for mass deportations. But today, we are exploring the bipartisan research indicating the opposite. We're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Professor Charis Kubrin, Professor of Criminology, Law, and Society at UC Irvine. Are immigrants more likely to commit serious crime than native-born Americans?
Not according to decades and decades of research, including my own studies over the last two decades. Across all studies, on average, immigrants are less likely to commit crime, an array of different crimes, compared to the native-born.
So it's more perhaps just a narrative, perhaps with an agenda behind it, that says immigrants commit more crimes?
That's exactly it. This narrative, unfortunately, has been around as long as the founding of our nation has been around. I teach a course at UC Irvine called Immigration and Crime in the Global Context. And one of the things I always tell my students is if you look back for decades, we have been vilifying immigrants in terms of blaming them for the crime problem for as long as we've existed, essentially, unfortunately.
Now, the data shows that immigrants are less inclined to commit crime than native-born Americans, and that seems to be true across various cultures. Do you have a theory as for why this is?
Yeah. So, by the way, I should just mention one thing, that there's been dozens and dozens of studies, as well as meta-analyses, that examine sort of the overall quantitative assessment of these studies, as well as books that report what the findings of these studies are. So there's lots of studies. That's not just my own work, plenty around the field of criminology. But actually, even though these findings are surprising to many, there's a lot of theory, as you suggested, that helps explain it. Just to give an example, immigrants, as we know, are not a random cross-section of ascending countries' population. They're instead a self-selected group. If you think about who comes to the United States, most do so for the opportunity to work. They want to improve their life chances. They're often highly motivated. They're hardworking. They're goal-oriented. And given all these characteristics, they're less likely to have high criminal propensities. But they also have strong incentives to remain law-abiding. They want to avoid interactions with the criminal justice system at all costs because that puts at risk all the effort and dedication. So that's just one theory. Another argument or theoretical perspective considers immigrant communities or ethnic enclaves. These are often areas that are characterized by really strong social ties among residents, extensive social networks, characteristics which minimize crime in communities. And there's others, there's lots of theories, but yeah, we have theory that supports these findings.
You know, if you watch the news for a day, you might think the opposite is true. It seems like so often we hear when there's some sort of heinous crime, the suspect is an immigrant from fill in the blank, or recently moved to the U.S. from fill in the blank. Yes, that okay, we hear that a lot, but we're less likely to hear the suspect is originally from Spokane, Washington, or something
exactly,
you know, like that. What do you make of the apparently political polarization over immigration and immigrant crime?
Well, to your point, I've asked, has anyone ever seen a headline that says native-born individual commits X, Y, or Z crime? No, that headline doesn't exist. right? And so what happens is in the minds of folks in society, whether it's through social media or news reporting or political rhetoric, the words immigration and crime sort of go hand in hand. And, you know, this narrative has real world consequences, because it's not just that people think the wrong thing relative to what the data say, but then they go and vote or they support policies or practices. And this is why we see a variety of challenges that we're experiencing today, everything from immigration policy that's problematic to a rise in hate crime and bias crimes against immigrants and folks of color, you know, so on and so forth. So there's real world consequences to this misperception.
I guess a media bias could factor into this. And I wonder, you know, everybody in just about every business, including the media, people are trying to do more with less, or just try to keep their heads afloat with less. They have fewer resources. So if somebody with an agenda says it's an immigrant from so-and-so who committed the crime, it's low hanging fruit, right?
Right. Exactly. I mean, I don't want to place all the blame on the media, because there's a lot of other factors that uphold this narrative, you know, whether, as I mentioned before, that's political rhetoric or xenophobia, racism on top of that, or just policies and practices that seem to make common sense on the one hand, but actually don't, or have collateral consequences associated with them, right? So, you know, there's a lot going on here, but correct. Yeah, the media do play a role, and it's very important that experts, I love that you have a segment called Ask an Expert. I think that's phenomenal, because I do think academia and academics and studies and research need to be a part of the conversation, particularly when it comes to immigration and crime, because what the data have to say here are unequivocal. This is not just a handful of studies, or this is not even a body of scholarship that has conflicting findings. You would be hard pressed to find a criminologist out there that would say, oh yeah, across these studies, immigrants commit more crime. No, it's pretty, as I mentioned before, it's pretty clear.
Hey y'all, I'm Maddie.
And I'm Poodle.
And together we host the podcast Reality Gaze.
We are two ridiculous homosexuals who love nothing more than talking about reality television
and tearing in a new one. So whether it's 90 Day Fiancé, Love is Blind, Love After Lockup, or any other trash TV show about lonely hearts looking for love, your gay besties got you covered, y'all.
New shows every week. Follow and listen to Reality Gaze wherever you get your podcast.
Let's love!
Professor, why do you think around the world so many people see immigrants as criminals? Is it because they, quote-unquote, look different from us, they sound different from us, and we're just uncomfortable?
Yeah, I think social psychologists have a lot of great theories that talk about sort of in and out groups and us versus them. And I think when societies experience problems of any kind, be they economic or cultural, institutional, or in terms of crime, it is often easy to look for scapegoats to blame the problem on. And immigrants often serve in that role. They have historically in the United States. And so when you see crimes, you know, rising or people concerned about crime, right, immigrants are often the first to be blamed for any crime problems. Yes, of course, individual immigrants do commit crime. We want to minimize those crimes. I'm certainly not here to say immigrants never commit crime, but if we actually care about crime, for example, in our society, and we want to lower it based on what the research says, focusing harsh policies on immigrants is actually not going to give us the public safety returns that we need. I offer other crimes that I think are much more problematic in American society, whether that's gender-based violence or gun violence, mass shootings, internet fraud. There's just a lot of other real problems that need to be addressed before we start tackling quote-unquote immigrant crime.
I wonder why statistically immigrants actually commit fewer per capita crimes than native-borns. Could it be from, you know, wherever they come from? Maybe they've escaped violence. They want to leave that behind. Mm-hmm. You've studied this. Why do you think the numbers show lower crimes per capita for immigrants?
Yeah, well, this goes right back to the theory question you asked me before. You know, just to go back to that example I talked about, if you think about why people are up and moving their entire life to another country, often a hostile context, to work for very low wages in a very challenging situation, right? It's because they want something better. Or maybe they're being pushed from another country that has all kinds of problems, be it violence or an authoritarian dictatorship. The idea that they would then just come here and want to commit crimes left, right, and center, that doesn't make sense given they are there to improve their life. So I think if you look at the characteristics of people that tend to engage in crime, they're short-sighted, they have low self-control, they're less likely to think long-term, right? They don't plan for the future. That is not, on average, who is coming to the United States. So that's just one concrete example that helps make sense of these findings.
If immigrants are less likely to commit crimes than native-born Americans, does it not suggest that deporting them would raise the per capita crime rate? Well, that's fascinating.
Yeah, that's an interesting math question. I mean, sort of all else equal, it does suggest that. The problem is nothing is ever all else equal, right? It would be very difficult to actually study that where we control for all of the other factors and forces, both related to immigration and crime, in order to isolate out sort of the you know, as demographers would say, the in and out, if you will, of immigration and in terms of deportation and folks arriving. But yeah, in the math on that is quite interesting. The thing with deportation that I think is important to point out, and we see this now in part because of a lot of policies that are targeting immigrants and deporting them on a very, very widespread scale, is that a lot of the individuals being identified and deported have not committed very serious crimes, and in some cases have not committed even misdemeanor crimes, right? We hear the rhetoric that we are deporting the worst of the worst. But if you look at actual data, you will see that very few of the individuals qualify for that category of the worst of the worst. And what this means is that the returns to public safety with ever-increasing numbers of deportation go down, right? The more you deport, the less likely you are to have significant folks that have committed violent crimes left to deport, which means that you are now deporting folks that have committed either immigration-related offenses or very low-level offenses. And then the consequences of that are that there's sometimes very strong collateral consequences to these policies. You're breaking up families. Those left behind now have economic instability. The children experience all kinds of ramifications of having a parent deported. These are conditions that could actually increase crime in the long run.
On the immigration front, outrage and further investigation follow a case where a nearly blind refugee from Myanmar was dropped off by U.S. Border Patrol at a Buffalo Donut shop miles from his home and was found dead 5 days later. Here's the latest from WBEN.
I'm Susan Rose.
I'm Brian Masurowski.
A Burmese refugee who died in Buffalo just days after he was released by Customs and Border Protection was laid to rest yesterday. Meanwhile, the family of the 56-year-old Narul Amin Shah Alam is calling for justice. Family friend Khalida Shah tells Channel 7 it's frightening that Shah Alam was found dead in freezing weather days after being dropped off at a closed Tim Hortons at Niagara and Ontario streets.
How in a place like the United States of America, how does something like that happen here? Like, we don't feel safe at all. The family does not feel safe. And here, especially in the city of Buffalo, we're supposed to be in the city of good neighbors. If our system is failing us, how can we trust our neighbors to be good to us?
Another family friend said Alam's family was waiting at the county jail for Shah Alam's release, unaware that Border Patrol had given him a ride.
This is actually sad. Like, they had all the paperwork. They paid the bond. They were waiting for the Narul Amin. He's going to come out. They're going to pick him up, go home, do the breakfast. And all of a sudden, like, they don't even know. They had to break their fast inside the car. But in the meantime, CBP came to pick him up and to just to figure out what's going on. Is he illegal? Are you taking to the holding center? But they don't know what happens.
Shah Alam discovered dead a few miles away on Perry Street near the arena late Tuesday night.
Mayor Sean Ryan said the man was in no condition to be left there.
And according to the preliminary information, you know, that's been released by the, not released by the medical examiners, is that he didn't have shoes on. He had orange booties issued from the holding center. So that's bad policing, but it's also bad human beings. That is an inhumane thing to do.
Well, Buffalo police detailing what led to Shah Alam's arrest last year and him ultimately spending a year at the Erie County Holding Center. Police say in February of last year they responded to a call at a home on Tonawanda Street where Shah Alam damaged a shed door and allowed the homeowner's dog to escape through an open gate. When police arrived, body camera footage shows Shah Alam approaching officers with two poles in his hands that he swung toward the officers until police took him down to the ground after tasing him. Shah Alam bit one officer on the left forearm, breaking the skin through the uniform shirt, bit a second officer on the left hand, also breaking the skin. He was held at the Erie County Holding Center on $25,000 bail that was modified to $5,000 cash or bond weeks later. He eventually pleaded guilty to two misdemeanor crimes.
We're asking you at WBEN.com if Shah Alam's release from custody should have been handled differently by authorities, yes or no. And so far this morning, a majority, 78% right now, have checked no.
So what is law enforcement to do? Here's Newell Normand from WWL in New Orleans, former sheriff of Jefferson Parish.
Talking about this policy now that NOPD is going to begin arresting people lying on, laying down on sidewalks, blocking the main travel portion for pedestrians, right? And in many cases, forcing pedestrians to go into the street. And we know that when you're in the main travel portion of the roadway where cars go, that's not safe, right? Not by any stretch of the imagination. It's horrible. And these folks are laying all over the French Quarter. And all I can say is thank you. Thank you to the NOPD. Thank you for starting to embark on this, having some consequences for this, and not allowing these folks to just take over this place called the French Quarter, which is so important to the economic success of the city. Human nature is the first impression is a lasting impression. We have visitors that come here. They walk into the quarter, and if the first thing they see are a bunch of these people laying around on the sidewalk, guess what? They're not coming back, right? So we lose these new wallets, as my friend puts it, that come into the city of New Orleans every day, and we lose the opportunity of them spending their money here with us, paying sales taxes and alike, and contributing to the success of this city. We have to pretty ourselves up. We need to be on our game every single solitary day because, as we all know, we are financially stressed and we cannot afford to let not a single day go by where we do not have our best foot forward. Pretty simple, in my view. We just have to recognize that we need to coordinate. We need to create efficiencies. We got to get on the same page. We got to play like that we're walking into the boardroom of a major corporation, and we look at the French Quarter and other areas in the city, whether it's the Warehouse District, Midtown, Downtown, however you want to refer to it, Mid-City, and say, this is our main responsibility. How can we succeed every day? And I dare say that inside that boardroom, I can't imagine that anyone is going to suggest that we should invite people to come and sleep on the sidewalks, that that would help perpetuate our product and the image of our product and help increase sales and would be a draw of tourists to this area. It's just not the selling point, right? But that's what we have. That's how our mindset has to be every day. I've said this about bucket beaters in front of Galatoire's, one of the most renowned restaurants in the country, right? A very important part of New Orleans history. And I just cannot imagine that we would walk into a boardroom and say, we think that bucket beaters in front of our restaurant during the dining hours is going to improve on the image and the nature of the experience that we're trying to provide to our dining guest each and every day. But yet we allow it to happen. We allow this to happen. What? How is that? Why is that? I have some people tell me they're culture bearers. Really? Who voted them in? There are very few people that I talk to that grew up and born and raised in New Orleans, grew up in New Orleans, that remember bucket beaters when they were growing up. Remembering that bucket beaters were influencing the culture of this city by any stretch of the imagination. No, we all know that that's BS, right? But what we have are some leaders that are not willing to consume political capital and not willing to play like they're sitting in a board of directors room making decisions for the viability of their business, the city of New Orleans, and taking care of business. Now, you know, interestingly, and we wonder why some of our competitor cities are so good at what they do, is because they're doing exactly as I just described. So let's go to Nashville. We know that Nashville, you know, is trying to steal the moniker of being the music city of this country. We have jazz. They're competing with us on that. They have their honky-tonk, whatever they call it, roadway, which is Broadway, that runs, you know, across the city to the Cumberland River over there. You know, and it's called the Honky Tonk Highway. I knew I had it written down somewhere. And, you know, so I've visited there a couple times, gone down on Broadway Street, and I saw the most incredible thing. I've told this story on your show before. You don't see anybody sitting down on a sidewalk. You don't see anyone sitting down on the stoops of businesses. Why? They don't allow it. Plain and simple. So I'm sitting there one day, and we're, you know, on the corner, and I see some people with backpacks sitting on the door stoop of a business that was closed for the evening. There are like five or six of them sitting there. They're not, they're actually not even really blocking the sidewalk, but they're just sitting there. And there's a guy that walks up. He's got a vest on, and he obviously works for whatever the organization that they have there on Broadway. And he says, y'all are going to have to stand up and move on, because we don't allow people to sit on the street, on the sidewalk, on the door stoops of these businesses, and it's just not allowed. Well, they started to give this young man lip. And he says, look, I'm going to say it again, but this time I'm going to expound on what I said the first time, is that if you don't get up in the next minute and you don't move on, those police officers not 20 yards away from me, right there standing next to that barricade, I will go over there and summon them. They're going to come over here and tell you the same thing. And if you don't stand up and move on within a minute, they are going to take you to jail. And it was really refreshing. You know, I mean, he was not in an argumentative way. It wasn't in an aggressive way. He was just laying out the facts. I'm giving you this opportunity. If you want to take this opportunity, you know, that's fine. But if not, I'm going to call the police over here, and then they're going to get involved. And this most incredible thing happened. I mean, you're just not going to believe it. They stood up and they moved on. Because obviously they probably have seen this play out at some other section of Broadway and on Broadway Street in Nashville. And they knew that these people were serious about what they're doing. Plain and simple. If you set the bar low, that's what you'll get. Garbage in your streets. Folks sitting on your door stoop, not following the rules. If you set the bar high and you're not willing to accept anything less, and you articulate what the rules are and what human behavior is accepted on Broadway Street or Bourbon Street or Royal Street or whatever, be that as it may, a quarter is a little bit bigger than the Honky Tonk Highway in Nashville. But it's just about being involved, being consistent, articulating the message, articulating what your expectation is of their behavior. And if they don't live up to that, they're gone. They go to jail. Plain and simple. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And the interesting thing about this is that, you know, you hear from some folks sometimes that want to make you believe that you're going to have a chilling effect on the culture, on the feel of Bourbon Street or the French Quarter if you get that intrusive. It's just simply not true. Because I can give example after example, the Gaslight District in San Diego, other areas that are that deploy the same type of strategies and tactics, that they set the bar, they're not willing to accept anything less. And what's interesting is that, you know, we have folks that want to make apologies for this. Really? I mean, you know, our culture is based on things that we've done historically, practices and stuff. Some of the human behavior that we're willing to accept in the French Quarter and other areas of the city, we didn't accept that 40 years ago. We didn't allow it. We didn't allow it at all. So why are we allowing this now? The customs and the practices of society are reflected in state statutes, city ordinances. That's all it is, right? But we didn't allow that 40 years ago. But why do we accept that today? We're lazy. We don't want to go about doing the things necessary to create safe spaces for our visiting folks that come to this city. And the real irony is this, and this has been going on for years, is that we talk about how we have to diversify because we just can't rely on tourism. But diversifying doesn't mean that we turn a blind eye to the things that we need to do every day to make sure that we are providing and developing and nurturing the culture that we need to be able to succeed in the tourism industry and compete against Nashville, right? Now, you go to Nashville, what you're going to find is all of these parties, young ladies are there, bachelorette parties, you know, this, that, and everything. Why? Because it's safe. That's why. They're not going to get hassled. They're not going to be stepping over people laying on the sidewalk. They don't want to have their bachelorette party and go see crap on the streets. That's not what they want. And we keep looking afar at what's happening there. We're seeing, you know, cranes popping up, hotels being built, more and more tourism going to that city. And we're wondering why. Why? Why? Well, we need to stop wondering. It's pretty simple. Act like we're in a boardroom and that we're all going to make a boatload of money off of an activity if we do it the right way and we offer a product to people that they can simply enjoy. They don't have to work at it. They don't have to be hassled. They can feel safe. They can have a great time. We provide architecture, scenery, and stuff that you can get nowhere else in the world. We have so many attributes that are so positive, and yet we don't leverage it. And over the last 40 years, we should never allow any of this to happen. We shouldn't have bucket beaters in front of iconic restaurants. We shouldn't have people laying in the streets of the French Quarter. How hard can this be? It can't be that hard. And I say that with full confidence because everybody else seems to figure it out.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Berry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
Hey everyone, I'm Josh Radner, and I am so excited to tell you about How We Made Your Mother, a rewatch podcast looking back at How I Met Your Mother. And I'm here with Craig Thomas, who co-created the show along with Carter Bays. Hi, Craig.
Hey, Josh. Somehow it has been 20 years since the show premiered. I'm going to check the math on that. 10 years since it went off the air, and we thought that made this a perfect time to look back, see what the hell we did, and why the show still seems to resonate with fans around the world today.
Follow and listen to How We Made Your Mother wherever you get your podcasts.